Part two now of our interview with Dr. Larry Dossey. Dr. Dossey graduated with honors from the University of Texas at Austin, earned his medical degree at Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. He was decorated for valor for his service as a battalion surgeon in Vietnam, and all this experience did not prepare him for his real life's work, writing about the future of medicine, combing through studies and finding the latest evidence that proves the point of concepts like non-local mind. His book on the healing capabilities of prayer, Healing Words, was a bestseller, and his new book is Reinventing Medicine, Beyond Mind-Body to a New Era in Healing. Dr. Dossey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Paul.
Non-local mind is what we were talking about in interview one, so for those who missed the first part of our chat, perhaps a thumbnail description of non-local mind is what is in question here.
Non-local mind is infinite mind. It's mind that reaches out to infinite regions of time and space. It can't be confined to our brain and our body or even to the present moment. It's mind, essentially, that's loose in space and time without limit.
When we're trying to explain the concept of non-local mind, the experience of being stared at is one familiar to just about everyone, I'd guess. And there have been several studies done on this phenomenon that explain a lot about Era 3 medicine in more ways than one. Studies from Australia and from Marilyn Schlitz and dream research pioneer Stephen LaBerge prove that there is something to it. So maybe their two studies is what we can start out with.
That's right. The so-called staring studies are an attempt to explain this very common event, which you imply, that, you know, we just sort of know that we're being stared at a stoplight or in a restaurant, and you look around, and sure enough, by golly, somebody's looking right at you.
Why don't you take a picture? It lasts longer. One of those lines. Huh?
That's exactly right. And so these researchers have done some elaborately controlled, beautiful studies showing that at a distance, even when you're staring not directly at a person's body, but an image of them on a television screen, the distant person still is able to punch the button and indicate when that distant person is staring at their image on the television screen. So this is, I think, vivid evidence that there's some form of distant communication that pushes us in the direction of non-local or infinite mind.
Not even staring at the person, but at a video image.
That's exactly right.
That's amazing. Now, there's a man who's a critic of the notion of non-local mind, or at least he was. I don't know if he still is. But that led to an interesting collaboration, one with Marilyn Schlitz, who was sort of in favor or predisposed to believing that there's something to the non-local mind, and Richard Wiseman, who didn't buy it. So they combined for a study which had some interesting results.
Well, Richard Wiseman is one of the great critics, cynics, and skeptics in Britain of this whole idea that people can communicate non-locally at a distance via their consciousness. And Dr. Schlitz, Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, has produced some studies showing that these staring things do seem to be able to connect people at a distance. So here you have Dr. Schlitz producing positive studies and Dr. Wiseman, who can't produce any positive findings in his experiments with this. So Wiseman invites Schlitz to come to Cambridge in England. And so they collaborate on the experiment. They run simultaneous experiments. They follow the same methods. They use the same subject pool. They do everything the same, with the single exception of the fact that Dr. Schlitz believes that this works and Dr. Wiseman is a complete skeptic. What happened in these studies is that Dr. Schlitz once again gets positive results showing that people can tell when they're being stared at a distance, and Dr. Wiseman, again, cannot produce anything. This suggests to both of them that perhaps your preconceived ideas about how things are going to work actually affects the outcome of your experiment. Now, this is a horrifying suggestion to a lot of people who are opposed to this idea that your thoughts can change the world in the first place. But this is one of the rational implications, I think, of these studies. And this is going to be, Paul, I predict, one of the hot topics in experimental science in the next millennium, the effect of the thoughts or the expectations of the experimenter on the actual experiment that that person is doing.
Well, that's come out of science of this century, the fact that just by virtue of watching the experiment, you're having an effect on it. And that has profound implications for the whole notion of this double-blind placebo notion of studies.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, physicists have wanted to restrict that effect to things like electrons. You know, you observe an electron and you change its behavior. And so that's been okay. But to apply this to the level of whole human beings, they've not wanted to go there. But these studies by Schlitz and Weissman seem really to be pointing in that direction.
One other notion about that, Dr. Weissman, if you have healthy skepticism, the emphasis on healthy, that's a good thing. But after a while, your skepticism becomes your disease. That's what Stephanie Skura, who does Skinner releasing technique, a non-traditional form of, I hate to use the word therapy, but a therapeutic sort of movement thing. And she says that's what happens to people. Their skepticism is really what is their disease.
That's exactly right. This leads to not science, but what has been called scientism. And it is a betrayal of science. I mean, scientists who play science the way it should be played are willing to follow the data wherever it leads them. It may be painful to go in that direction because it may involve fear and hesitation and so on.
And loss of ego.
And loss of ego, maybe loss of grants, you know, loss of prestige, loss of standing in the eyes of your colleagues. But science is a tough path to follow because it involves setting the ego aside and setting aside your preconceptions and really putting it on the line and saying, I don't care where the evidence leads. If the evidence solidly points in that direction, I'm willing to go there. The fact is, sadly, that when it comes to consciousness, and particularly these areas where the mind begins to appear non-local, in violation of everything we've been taught, the sad thing is that there are a lot of scientists who refuse to go there.
And we'll wait for their funerals.
Science changes funeral by funeral.
There
that's
you,
right.
There
Good
you
old
go.
Max Planck.
Non-local mind in animals is now the subject of, I think, every other book that comes into this place. And when you describe non-local mind in animals, Napoleon is one person who's a believer.
Well, Napoleon had an experience on one of the battlefields in Western Europe once where the animal seemed to find his dead master across this battlefield that was strewn with dead bodies, and he was amazed that this animal was able to do this. So we do have that little vignette that comes down through Napoleonic annals about this.
Yeah, and lots of other examples quoted in the book. Now, Rupert Sheldrake, who is a respected scientist from England, he's a very firm believer in the notion of non-local mind in animals. He's got a book, in fact, on the subject, and we hope that he'll be a future guest of this show. And he's also the person who helped you decide on the term non-local mind in the first place, a friend of yours.
That's right. Rupert Sheldrake's research grabbed my attention around 15 years ago. He was a respected Cambridge biologist who actually came up with the idea that the mind does behave in infinite ways. And he was deeply influenced by his own experiences and his own spiritual tradition. And I had occasion to connect with him at conferences and invited him to my home in Dallas at the time. And he came and stayed with us. And we went out to eat one night, and we began to talk about what to call this. I mean, we can't, you know, we need a good term to refer to this aspect of our consciousness that behaves non-locally. And so I floated the term to him, non-local mind, and asked him what he thought about it. And I'm happy to say that he gave it his blessing. He said he thought it was one of the best terms that he had heard to refer to this quality of the mind in a long time.
Now, when we talk about Sheldrake, he's developed a theory that, now he didn't come up with the theory, but he's developed it, that attempts to explain how non-local mind works, the notion of morphogenetic fields. Yet, scanning the book and reading it, I didn't see this covered in the book.
Actually, I will plead this. I have given Rupert Sheldrake's morphogenetic field theory so much ink in my past books, I sort of decided to give it a rest in this one. People have told me, you know, you're just fronting for Sheldrake. You know,
exactly.
Refer to his work so often, and indeed I have. Actually, Rupert Sheldrake, I have to say, is one of my heroes in science. I think he's one of the most courageous, creative people out there today. So I'll get back to talking about Rupert probably in my next book.
But that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about emotions and thoughts that have energy, that travel, that do not lose any energy as they travel. This is very essential to the notion of non-local mind and how it works.
That's exactly right. We see this, for example, in distant healing, distant prayer. You know, people have tried to figure out whether prayer is more effective or whether its strength is greater if you do it up close at the bedside of the sick person, for example, as opposed to the other side of the earth. It doesn't make a darn bit of difference. So we can say that space is not a factor here. I mean, it doesn't help to be close up. People have even put patients in so-called Faraday cages, which are lead-lined or metal-lined boxes, to see if they can block the effect of the prayer, as if it's some sort of electromagnetic signal that you could shield. This doesn't work. So, you know, no one knows how intercessory or distant prayer healing intentions work, but they certainly don't behave like ordinary forms of electromagnetic energy, which can be shielded and which get weaker the farther apart you get from the source of it.
I have that mental picture of somebody in one of these cages, and also this other mental picture of God laughing, for crying out loud.
If God has a sense of humor, probably this made her laugh.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Dr. Larry Dossey is our guest. His new book is Reinventing Medicine, Beyond Mind Body to a New Era in Healing. I'm Paul Nelson. Now, you're a respected medical doctor. You served in Vietnam. Certainly could not be pegged as a left-wing, granola-eating, West Coast kind of person. Well, maybe not in the past, but maybe not. Maybe now you will be. But people who believe in paranormal phenomena are not kooks either. And a study from the meat-eating town of Chicago bears this out. The NORC study is what I refer to. You want to tell us about that?
That's exactly right. You know, people who have experiences involving telepathy and clairvoyance and so on have been ridiculed by skeptics and cynics for so long as being mentally unbalanced. But the National Opinions Research Center, so-called NORC, from the University of Chicago, actually did psychological evaluations on people who had these radical, far-out parapsychological experiences, such as the sense of being bathed in white light and being connected with all there is. And they found that having these experiences was the best predictor of solid, normal mental health of any criterion they had ever discovered. So far from being an indicator of mental ill health, having these paranormal experiences is an indicator of normal psychological health and balance. So this is one area, again, where the skeptics have managed to turn this totally upside down and give a false impression of this field.
Twist it again to benefit mediocrity and the lowest common denominator.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, people who buy into natural medicine have a sense that all disease has some spiritual component. This is a 180-degree turn, as we're saying, from era one medicine, where the person is just a machine that needs a new part when one part goes bad.
That's exactly right. And I think this is a profound insight. It certainly is a recovery of ancient wisdom, where this connection between spirituality and physical health was simply taken for granted. You know, I think that doctors need to understand the connection between spirituality and alternative medicine a good deal better. There was a survey that was published in December of 98 out of Stanford by Dr. John Aston, and it was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It contained a great insight. The name of this survey was, "Why Do People Use Alternative Medicine?" And he found out that the main reason people are out there going to alternative therapies by the millions is not because they've looked at the scientific studies and they have, you know, done their homework and they have proved that ginkgo actually works to make you more cognitively alert. They use these methods because of spiritual reasons, basically. People who've opted for alternative medicines, Aston found out, have had some sort of transformative spiritual experience in their life, which drives them in this direction. So this return of spirituality in modern healthcare is tied to this enthusiasm for alternative therapies in our culture. So we got to link these things together, this movement toward alternative measures and the return of spirituality.
So when we look at something that might be described as being woo-woo, a little bit out there, like Louise Hay, we're beginning to think that there's some science that backs this up. Are you familiar with her work?
Yes, I am. I got to say that, you know, if you look back at some of the things that now we take for granted, 20 years ago, we called them wacko West Coast, too. I'll give you an example in medicine. This idea that social support was good for health. The skeptics and cynics had a field day with this. They laughed researchers and social support, you know, out of the meetings. How could it be that just because you went bowling once a week, you know, and you met with your buddies and, you know, went to church or something like, what difference could this make in health? Now, this is under the wire. This is taken for granted. I don't know of anybody who objects to the idea that social support is good for people's health. We offer the same sort of resistance now to these infinite non-local expressions of consciousness. And my prediction, Paul, is that we too will overcome our intellectual indigestion toward this, just like we did to this idea of social support being helpful.
And then we'll begin to do things like create a national dream team. Oh. And we're not talking about hoops here.
No, we're not talking hoops. Actually, I am so impressed by the fact that there are prodigies out there who really do have this great skill of dreaming the future, that we ought to sort of use this, capitalize this for the common good. And so I have proposed that we find ways of identifying people with these natural talents, these people whose consciousness sort of infinitely retrieves information from the future and from great distances, and have them dream for example, national security. We got close to this with the remote viewing research that the CIA sponsored in the past decade, and there are some astonishing accomplishments of that effort. So I offer this in all seriousness. I think that this is a great potential resource that we ought to take advantage of.
Maybe a thumbnail sketch of the Dream Helper ceremony is what we could get now to get a sense of how dreams work in healing.
Right. Dream Helper ceremonies have been used by dream researchers as a therapeutic tool. And the way this works is that a common group of people will come together, and one person will declare that they need some assistance in insight or in an attempt to gain understanding about personal problems and so on. And so the rest of the people in the group that night will devote their dreams seriously to trying to gain an insight about the solution for this person's dilemma. And the next day they meet together and they share what they saw. And Stanley Krippner, Dr. Krippner, is director of research at the Institute of at Saybrook Institute, and other people who have refined this technique are astonished at the information that comes to the people, various members of the dreaming group that apply to solving the problem that the individual is dealing with.
The black and white dream, for example, everybody having some kind of aspect of black and white in their dream and how it applies to the person.
The individual who wanted help was facing a crisis in her life she couldn't solve. The dominant theme in the dreams of the people who dedicated their dream life to solving this problem that night were black and white. One person dreamt of black and white piano keys. Another person dreamt of a black and white design taxi.
Dr. King in front of the White House.
Dr. King in front of the White House, and so on. And so this woman revealed later, after all of these people revealed the black and white themes of their dreams, that she was involved with a relationship with a black man. And this has caused all sorts of interpersonal conflict in her life. Her relationships with her parents were on the rocks, and so she was trying to find guidance about which way to go in this relationship. And the feedback that the people were able to give her, who dreamt these black and white themes, helped her resolve this dilemma.
Go slow.
That's right.
Examples of watches going slow or something like that in other dreams.
That's exactly right. And this theme also in the black and white motif involved a slowing down of time in many of these dreams that these people had. So they were able to give her feedback that suggested that she really take this slow, that she make no precipitous decisions, that she work through this till she's comfortable with it before embarking on any definitive path.
Yes, and we realize through your work and other work that you cite that time is a field, and we can get into that aspect of non-local mind, but we're running out of time, and there's one last thing I really want to get into, and I think it's critical. The most important lesson from the dying might also lessen our society's rampant fear of death, and that is to suggest that with the advent of the awareness of non-local mind, death is not an end.
Well, I think that this may be the most important implication of infinite or non-local mind. You see, a mind that does behave with disregard to space and time is a mind that is omnipresent in space, and it's infinite in time, therefore immortal and eternal. Well, if we have some aspect or quality of our mind that's immortal, we're talking about survival in some sense of bodily of death. There seems to be some aspect of the consciousness that is eternal if we take these implications seriously. I think we should, because if we were able to assure dying people that there's some quality of who they are that couldn't even die if it tried, this would be the greatest comfort we could give dying people, in my judgment.
Well, your work is going to last a long, long time. And this is very obvious. I'm very grateful to not only be able to be exposed to your work, but to have you on my radio show.
It's an honor for me, Paul. Thank you.
The places where people can get more information, of course, we mentioned your website, DosseyDossey.com. That's D-O-S-S-E-Y, D-O-S-S-E-Y.com. And Taste is another resource for people who want more information. And that one of the websites, issc-taste.org. And we'll have that URL on our website. Continued success, Larry.
Thank you, Paul.
Dr. Larry Dossey has been our guest. His new book is Reinventing Medicine, Beyond Mind-Body, to a New Era in Healing.